Hang on. Colonel Warburton, reel 5. We were talking about when you pulled into Nijmegen with these three supply lorries. That was where we were interrupted.
It was actually Nijmegen where the Sherwood Rangers were at that time. It was just outside Nijmegen, actually. And the colonel was quite rude when he saw that my retinue of 4 3-tonners. However, they were soon dispatched on their way to their proper unit, and all peace again. But he took a very dim view of me arriving in 4 3-tonners.
Now, what was the situation in the Nijmegen area for the Sherwood Rangers and for your unit?
When we got there, we joined up with the American 82nd Airborne, who landed
And what were they like, the 82nd Airborne Division?
These were some of the finest troops we came across. They were very well disciplined and extremely tough.
In what way?
Well, they were just plain tough. Really, they certainly were not people who wanted to argue with them. They were very, very tough characters. I wouldn't like to know where they were recruited from, but they were very good. And without them, it would have been extremely difficult to hold on to the Nijmegen Bridge, which was the key to the whole thing.
Now, what do you remember of what you were doing in this period, generally in the Nijmegen area?
Well, when Nijmegen area was finally secured, and the bridgehead finally secured...
Now, what were you doing before that, though? I mean, during that period, or were you just normal duties?
Well, we were... Really, I think we were defending it against counterattacks and things with these American people.
So you were just bringing down support fire?
Yes, that was really it. Yes. And after then, we had quite a peaceful sort of time. It was Christmas time. Because we went to a place called Beek, which is just outside Nijmegen. And we were there, again, just in a holding position. We weren't really doing very much. Although the guns were in action, they weren't being used an awful lot. Not as far as the Sherwood Rangers were concerned, anyway.
And what do you remember of the...
But I did have one very interesting experience there. I went up into Germany for the first time. really to see if I could see anything going on.
Well, tell me about that, the whole story. What happened?
I found myself standing in a small orchard, and I'm looking forward. I saw troop of German guns moving along a lane, and looked as though they were coming into action.
Now, were you with your tank, or were you on your own?
I was with my tank then. And very shortly after they'd come into action, I noticed a company of German infantry advancing across an open field towards where the American 82nd Army was entrenched. And fortunately, was able to call on some gunfire immediately, which broke up the infantry company and then turned attention to the troop of guns, a troop of German guns, and after a few shells had dropped very close to them, they also retired, so that the intended attack never actually took place. And it was a very satisfactory feeling.
Did you get...
And I don't forget, hardly anybody knows about that at all, except by signals and the gun end. They didn't know what it was all about at all. It's very satisfactory to you. And really, it's the world for after that they do that sort of thing. It's ideal.
Anything else about that reconnaissance into Germany?
Pardon?
Anything else about that reconnaissance into
Germany? No, that was it. I was only a few hundred yards inside Germany. But it was one of the first times that anybody had been into Germany. Actually, trodden on German soil.
Whereabouts was it? Do you know?
Well, it was near Beek.
So in that same quiet period, that's what...
Yes, yes. And then after that... We then started advancing into Germany.
Do you remember crossing the Rhine? That was it. Would it that yes, be March?
I do. We crossed the. Well, where the hell? We crossed the Rhine. We crossed the Rhine on a raft. Which was towed across, pulled across by a wild rope.
What was that like?
But while we were waiting for the engineers to rig up the winches, we were standing on the banks of the Rhine, and unknown to us, behind a hedge on our side, a regiment of rocket launchers, you know, rocket things, had installed themselves, and quite unexpectedly, the whole lot, they fired around, the whole lot used to go off together, they turned like 24 or 36 or something, and they made the most hideous noises that came right over us, you see, and we wonder what the hell has happened, because we hadn't seen them come at all, they just arrived, and we gave them an awful shock. But eventually, they got this raft. It wasn't literally a raft.
How many?
We put one tank lot on it.
What was it like crossing on that?
And it was. We were told that. We said, "What happens if the blessed wire breaks?" He said, "Don't worry, because down there we've got a gun sighted to sink you, so you don't fall into German hands." Which was very consoling, I must say. So we kept our fingers crossed and hoped the wire kept, and it did. And we had quite a safe crossing, and things seemed to go quite well from then onwards.
What do you remember about the advance into Germany?
I remember seeing our own airborne being dropped the other side of the Rhine, that was a very inspiring sight. But I had a pretty rough time, but no scouts.
What was what state was Germany in when you started moving forward?
Well, we didn't see any German civilians hardly at all.
How battered were the towns and villages?
They were pretty battered. The one thing we did at Nijmegen, we used to at one stage. Now, what stage was that? We used to. Send lawyers somehow or other. I'm thinking how it could have happened. They found that the Germans that they occupied Holland took a lot of furniture and stuff out of the houses and took it into Germany. But we used to use our lawyers for bringing the furniture back. I can't remember what stage that happened. They'd go up with ammunition and stuff, and then pack their lodge with this furniture stuff and bring it back into Holland for these houses that have been robbed. I can't remember at what stage that happened. It seems to be a very laudable thing to be doing. I think it was happening when we were well into Germany, I think that was the thing. So we went up to Bremerhaven then.
Now, you just remembered that you were involved in the Ardennes operation. What do you recall of that?
We had been engaged in Holland, and were suddenly ordered to load all our tanks onto low loaders, which had suddenly arrived, and through the night we moved the entire brigade, armored brigade, down into the Ardennes. And in our place, a train drew up into the siding with the wireless frequencies and call signs of our division actively working throughout the night to give the illusion to the Germans who had listening in things that our division was still in stationed in Holland. Whereas in fact we were something like 100 miles further south. The Ardennes was very confused because the first few days there was a lot of fog about and our aircraft were unable to fly. And the Germans were very determined to break through, and we had a lot of alarmist stories of Germans dressed as Americans and American jeeps. But however, in the end, we managed to survive, and the fog cleared, and the Air Force was able to get busy, and the flap was over. But it was a very serious threat at one time.
Were you involved in much of the fighting yourself?
Yes, we were engaged in supporting the counterattack to the Ardennes, which succeeded in the end. But it was quite a struggle.
Now, what about the advance through Germany after you crossed the Rhine?
Then after that, we went on and we...
That was in January, the Ardennes finished, and you crossed the Rhine, presumably in March.
We're up here, aren't we? Well, there was continuous fighting the whole time. It was, but nothing, it didn't seem to be anything of serious to help us up. And when we got to Bremen, when we came to Bremerhaven, we were anxious to try and get the port. But before we went in, it was very heavily bombed. And we watched all this going on from a very safe distance, expecting to find Bremerhaven completely flattened when we moved in later. And very much to our surprise, it was difficult to find where the bombs had landed. It really was quite extraordinary. We were seeing it from the distance. The whole place seemed to be smothered in smoke and bangs and absolute chaos. And yet when we got in, we were able to drive in, and it was comparatively, I wouldn't say undamaged, but it wasn't absolutely flattened. But we had no difficulty with taking it. And then we moved on then to the end, really.
What do you remember of V-Day? And
V-Day, well, I remember we were advancing through a wood. It must have been really nowhere near anywhere. And with the leading squadron, and on this occasion the squadron leader was in front of, was leading the people, and I was then second, I was following him, and there was another tank following me, and the fourth tank, but the most monumental explosion, and it had gone over a culvert, and it had let off onto his landmine. And burned it to smithereens, burned this tank up to smithereens. And it had got evidently it had one of these ratchet fuses. It let three or four tanks come on, and then when the fifth one came off, it went. So that the ones that were over couldn't get back, and you had them there sitting up. But fortunately, nothing more happened.
And that was actually on VE Day.
And this was the morning of VE Day. And then shortly afterwards, we got the message that all was all finished. We were within an hour or so anyway. And we stopped. And we just stopped. There. We just didn't know what to do, really. And the Sherwood Rangers had a very efficient supply arrangement. And within the hour, the colonel arrived with bottles of champagne, which enabled us to celebrate in a suitable manner.
How wild were the celebrations?
But there was no wild, we didn't go wild celebrating anything. We were too tired, I suppose, really. There was great relief that it was all over. And then great anxiety what was going to happen now, sort of thing. But we eventually were given orders to move on to Kiel, where we occupied Kiel.
What happened there?
And really had a very pleasant experience in most of us. We took over the Kiel Yacht Club, complete with some 20 or so Dragon class yachts, and we had some very good sailing around Kiel Harbour, which is really, you said, more like Pool Harbour, but it's very extensive place. Kiel housed the submarines for the German Navy, and I was able to go and inspect these pens.
What were they like? What do you remember of that?
Which were quite intentional. They were under enormous concrete caves, really. Enormous things in the water. And the officer, the German officer showed me around, showed me with great pride a picture of HMS Edinburgh, which was a German destroyer, I believe, which was taking the gold stuff to the Russians.
British ship, yeah.
Yes. He showed the picture. He was the man who sank it. He was the chap, and he showed me this photograph of this thing going down. And subsequently, we were heard that the man who was with that fleet was Admiral Sherbrooke from Nottingham, who got the VC. And it was all on the telly, this thing, and I was thinking at the time, only I could have remembered the name of the chap who did it. He wouldn't be left as a trooper. Anyway, that was that, and they had an enormous crane that could lift 900 tons. It was the only two in the world, apparently. Which could lift these companies off the seabed. And it was a great difficulty that we managed to get that sent to this country instead of going to Russia. But we did. And then I personally had a spell of in charge of the Kiel Wick prison at Kiel, which was full of German Kriegsmarine, some 6,000 I think there were there, who were extremely well disciplined and firmly of the opinion that they had not lost the war, it was the army that had lost the war. But I found them to be of no trouble at all. Although we did have some incident in the special security wing of the prison, where they had been housed the man from not Belson, Auschwitz or whatever they call the place, who did the dental man responsible for removing the gold teeth from the wretched victims in the camp. He was given some rather rough treatment, which had to be dealt with at the time. And, but from my own personal view, it was a very unusual experience. And they did have a card at this prison, a German R boat with its crew of 12, which was put at my disposal. And then, after some persuasion, I was asked to go for a trip up to the Baltic in this boat, which I did. And we had a wonderful journey until I suddenly realized that I'd probably pushed my luck a bit.
You were alone with some Germans?
Yes, but I was alone on the Baltic Sea with 12 Germans who didn't think they'd lost the war. However, their discipline was such that they came back having thoroughly enjoyed themselves, and I equally enjoyed myself, and was much more relieved with getting back in one piece. And they were asking me when they'd be able to go again, but I thought better next time. While we were here, we had endless opportunities for playing games, and we had, this was summer then, we had quite a good cricket ground.
Did you play?
But some people seem to be quite happy enjoying the local brew to the full, and doing very little else.
What was the attitude of most of the civilian Germans, you know, in the Kiel area? Because there was supposed to be a non-fraternisation ban as well.
Well, there was certainly that. There was, the non-fraternisation made it difficult for the people to integrate. And there was becoming this fearful problem of displaced people. And we were continually being asked where they could find their fathers and mothers and those sort of things. And it was very difficult. But we did our best to help them when we could. I had a very good German interpreter with me who speaks fluent English. And, this is a very unusual experience for me, but I had to be very careful and as strict as I could without being over strict.
Were you aware of the black market and the problems with that?
No, I wasn't. We weren't really conscious of it, although there clearly was something going on, because everybody in Germany seems to walk about with a dispatch box. You know those briefcase things? Everybody all seems to be walking about with one of those, and I never quite knew what was inside.
How long were you at Kiel?
I was at Kiel until we were then I was sent home, you know, disbanded or whatever they called it.
And when was that? Roughly.
I think I was back for Christmas, that year.
So, till December?
Yeah.
Nothing else? So, it was just a matter of routine, basically?
Yes, it was. We had, we were told Monty was coming in to Peel, and he'd take exception to our unit wearing berries. See, we wore black berries, digging the tank thing, you see. And he'd given an express order that the SSM were not to wear black berries. However, we discovered that he was coming to Kiel and made quite certain that the entire regiment was confined to barracks until he'd gone. And then we walked out in our black berries again.
Did you see Montgomery at the time? At all?
No. I don't think I ever saw him until after the war.
Now, what about, how come you were sent home in December? Was that just your demobilisation, December?
Yes, that, I was demobilised at York, I think, Central.
And what do you remember of the demobilisation? How did they go about it?
I was issued with a clothing. I can't really remember much else about it at all when I came home.
Now, what about settling back into civilian life? How did you manage that?
Well, it was very difficult because my business had folded up during the war, and I was virtually starting from scratch again. However, I was very fortunate in finding myself a job on the sales side with an engineering firm manufacturing wire ropes. And this I enjoyed very much indeed. Eventually became a member of the board.
Which engineering firm was it?
It was a private firm called John Shaw Limited. And I was there for 20 years or so.
Had the war had any effects on you, mentally or physically, would you say? Good or bad?
Very good. I think the experience of the war was a tremendous feature of my life and made a very great deal of difference to my approach to living and life altogether.
In what way, would you say?
Well, it broadened my outlook, for one thing. We somehow seem to be very... Things that used to be important now seem to be of no consequence whatever. One is much more likely to get one's priorities in some sort of correct sequence. I personally think it's one of the best experiences anyone could ever have. I mean, you get to know men and you get to know the important things in life, you know, things that really do matter.